Case number 20-1112 et al. Communications Workers of America, AFL-CIO petitioner versus National Labor Relations Board. Mr. Ginsburg for the petitioner, Mr. Weitz for the respondents, Mr. Theodore for the intervener.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Please proceed.
Thank you. Good morning, and may it please the court, Matthew Ginsburg on behalf of the petitioner, Communications Workers of America. Your Honors, T-Mobile told employee Chelsea Beffert that it was reprimanding her for sending an email to her coworkers because that email concerned the union. That alone constituted a violation of the NLRA. In addition to this direct evidence, the circumstances also strongly suggest that T-Mobile discriminated against Beffert because of the union content of her message. T-Mobile routinely permitted other employees to send email invitations to personal events like birthday parties and baby showers. Only Beffert's invitation to a weekend social event at a bowling alley was singled out for censure, and that was because T-Mobile perceived the event as a union meeting. The company's after-the-fact explanations for its actions are wholly implausible and strongly suggest pretext. T-Mobile acknowledged it had never previously applied any of the policies it invoked as reasons for reprimanding Beffert. And T-Mobile's characterization of Beffert's email as quote-unquote junk mail highlights the fact that the company targeted Beffert's email because it disagreed with her message. The board's dismissal of the discrimination claim in the face of all this evidence was based on a fundamental legal error. The board held that the general counsel failed to meet its burden of showing that T-Mobile, quote, permitted employees to send mass emails for their personal benefit or, quote, to further any organizational purpose. But T-Mobile did not prohibit emails on either ground and did not justify its action on either basis.
So help me understand. I think I understood the board to say, because we adopted a new standard in the middle of this case, we're going to apply that standard because we've held that that standard applies retroactively to any case that's pending. And the union never challenged that before the board. And therefore, as it were, arguably, it's stuck with that rule that applies retroactively. So the board says, applying that rule, the general counsel failed to meet his burden to show that the employer discriminatorily applied its policies. Why is that either legal error or factual error by the board?
So, Your Honor, With respect, I don't think that I do not think that's actually the board's argument. I believe that the board's argument is that the board applied the register guard standard.
Let me put it this way.
Yep.
I'm reading the board's decision, mm-hmm. and I'm looking at what it said. And that's what my question is based on.
Right. Okay. So as we explained in the reply brief, and in fact, as the employer said as well, the discrimination standard has not changed from Register Guard to Purple Communications to the current board decision of Caesars Entertainment.
That's a legal error by the board in how it interprets its precedent?
If the board says that it's changed its precedent, with all respect, I don't see in the board's decision anywhere where it says it's changed its discrimination rule.
Well, maybe I'd characterize it, but it says we have overruled Purple Communications, and in Caesars Entertainment, we adopted this rule, and you cannot discriminate. Basically, it says, as far as Section 7 is concerned, unless you can show that the employer allowed something that was of the same character and now it's disallowing it.
Yes. And so that I agree that is the board's legal test. I guess the only point of disagreement with the interpretation that we're having is that I believe that legal test is clear in Register Guard and that the board just readopted it, both in Purple Communications, which dealt with email more generally, and then in Caesars Entertainment, which flipped back to Register Guard. But throughout the through line through those cases is the discrimination standard, which hasn't changed. And I don't think the board in its decision was suggesting it had changed. But what we're quarreling with is that we think the board has misstated what that standard is going all the way back to Register Guard.
To some extent,
page 14, let me just.
Sure.
Judge Pullen. So when the board says, in other words, unlawful discrimination consists of disparate treatment of activities or communications of a similar character because of their union or other Section 7 protected status, you would agree that that's the standard under board precedent?
Yes, we agree that's the standard. We just think that when the board then goes in the next paragraph and says that what that means is that the union has to show that the employer permitted employees to send emails for personal benefit or organizational purpose, that's not a correct application of that standard under this court's case law, review of Register Guard itself.
And so that is I'm trying to understand, that's a legal error,
yes,
or that's a factual error in finding that the employer had not previously allowed communications of similar character?
So thank you for that question, because I think that goes right to the heart of things. It's a legal error because the board, after in the first paragraph correctly stating the broad rule, it must be similar activity, then restates it in a way that is error. And it's error in exactly the same way that the board erred in Register Guard and this court reversed in part in its decision in Guard Publishing, which is to say that the similar activity turns on, you know, the question of similarity, as Judge Easterbrook sort of famously put it in the Guardian Publishing decision that preceded this court's decision in Guard Publishing, you have to look at what is the baseline for comparison. And in for example, and we use this example in the brief, in Register Guard, the board said, well, that union email was for an organizational purpose, so that the employer was permitted to prohibit it. This court said, well, wait a second. No, you have to look at the employer's rule to see what the baseline of comparison is. In that case, the employer rule was no solicitation generally. So the employer picking and choosing on the basis of organizational status was applying the wrong baseline. So they were applying the discrimination rule incorrectly. And that's exactly what the board has done here. The board has said the general rule, you have to look at whether the communications are of similar character, but then when it goes to apply it, it puts this legal gloss on it of organizational purpose or personal benefit, which has no basis in the employer's rule here. There's nothing in the employer's rule about those things. And the employer, in fact, hasn't sought to justify its actions on those bases at all. So that's a legal error. And then all the factual of course, once you have that fundamental legal error of what the standard is, then trying to apply that to the facts creates all sorts of problems, because we think the discrimination is clear here when you correctly apply the legal test. I hope that answered your question, Judge.
So the baseline is the employer's policies that were in place at the time of the discipline, as well as any stated reasons at the time?
So the baseline, so I wanna, if I may, I'd like to take a half a step back in answering your question. You know, like any discrimination case, there's a variety of evidence here. There's the direct evidence, the contemporaneous stated reasons the employer gave for its actions, which in this case all involved it was union activity. So we think that's-
I have a bone to pick on that, but
okay.
Yeah, go ahead.
And then you have the circumstantial evidence, which goes to the comparators, and the comparators are based on what the employer's rules were. Here, what we know about the employer's rules is that they generally allowed personal use of email. And there's evidence, for example, of invitations to other non-work social events like birthday parties and baby showers. And so we, you know, our argument is that this is similar. This was an invitation to a weekend social event at a bowling alley. Yes, it was to talk about working conditions, but it's similar in all meaningful ways under the employer's policy to what they permitted. Then the third piece of evidence is then the employer after the fact comes in and points to some of its policies and says, no, that wasn't permitted under these other policies. And we think that, as the ALJ found, and the board doesn't disturb this, that we think those, that just shows pretext. I mean, this is, was not junk mail within any meaningful sense of junk mail, which was the main policy the employer pointed to here. So there's sort of three buckets of evidence, the direct evidence, the circumstantial evidence, and the pretext evidence. So if this were a Title VII case and you were presented with these different buckets of evidence, they would all point in the same direction. And that's how we present.
All right, I think I'm structuring it slightly differently. And, you know, rather than direct and circumstantial, I'm thinking about it as, what are we measuring it against? We're measuring the employer's conduct as, you know, if it's prohibited by the policy, well, that's one thing. It could still be discrimination if it's prohibited by the policy, but violations of the policy have otherwise been tolerated, right?
Yes.
But if it's not even under the policy, which is what the ALJ found, and I don't think that that's been disturbed by the board, if it's not even under the policy, then we have to look at, well, you know, employers can do things other than what's in their policy. And then we have to evaluate those for whether they're being done in a discriminatory manner. And here, Elliot gives a bunch of reasons that overlap with but are slightly distinct from the policies, which the ALJ refers to as newly promulgated policies. And so then we have to look at those and see, again, with comparators, like, are they legitimate? And B, are they being non-discriminatorily applied, right? And that's where you come up with potentially proof of pretext that they're being discriminatorily applied. Does that make sense to you?
Yes, I understand. I mean, I guess I have a little bit of a difficult time understanding how what Elliot said for the first time in his email after the fact, why that should be considered part of the employer's policy that we use as a basis for comparison, since obviously until he said it, at least parts of what he said, nobody had ever heard any of those rules before, as everybody
right.
seems to
I
acknowledge.
Guess it depends on whether he's characterizing it as an existing rule. I mean, if nobody ever, you know, brought a, you know, a garbage bag into the office, and there was no policy against bringing your, you know, your composting reeking into the office, and the employer just said, like, actually, take that home. I don't want that in the office, and didn't in any discriminatory way do that. Like, there's nothing, employer prerogative persists even if it's not codified, is I guess what I'm saying. And then the question becomes, you know, how is that prerogative being exercised?
Right. I understand. I mean, I guess the things I would say are that there is good comparative evidence here about what
right.
the practice was.
But so going back to the Elliot email, you say that T-Mobile gave only one explanation and that it was anti-union. But Elliot's email says, you know, what's not appropriate is sending emails to large numbers of employees. And then in the next paragraph, he says, you know, y'all have rights to join the union. And he puts it in a context that is, you know, not as you can sort of condense it as that he's saying emails about the union are not appropriate. And that's, I'm not sure that's a fair reading of his email. We don't allow mass communication. It's not appropriate to solicit for any purpose. And then he goes to the next paragraph. Since this email addressed union issues, I'd like to take an opportunity to respond. Nobody's being silenced, blah, blah, blah. You can talk in break areas. You can talk from home. You can use social networks off the job, of course. Now that's in tension with the past policy.
Right. Well, two responses, Your Honor. One is that prior to this email, Ms. Beffert was individually counseled by her team manager, Miss Lillian Moran, who it was all about the union nature of the email and when you couldn't send emails and you couldn't, she said you could or you couldn't use, at one point she said you could not use work email at all to send emails to coworkers about the union. And I guess our point is—
That's a separate piece of evidence. You had characterized the Elliott statement as anti-union.
I believe, if I did, I misspoke. I meant those two pieces of evidence, okay, which occurred on the same day. Those were the two interactions that occurred contemporaneously or immediately after Ms. Beffert sent her email the following Tuesday. She was counseled, and then the facility-wide email from Elliott went out on the same day. In fact, she got back to her desk from her counseling and had received Elliott's email. So we take those together as contemporaneous evidence that what the employer was focused on was that the union nature of the email. I'm past my time. I'm of course happy to answer questions from the panel, but.
I have two about the kind of secondary issues in this case.
Sure.
Were you finished, Judge Pillard?
Yeah, go ahead.
If we conclude that the rebuke of Beffert was lawful, I know you disagree with that, but if we make that conclusion, does that mean that the new rules that were later promulgated in response were also lawful?
No, Your Honor. And as we explain, particularly in our reply brief, although also in our opening brief, everybody agrees, all sides agree that if you agree with us on the discrimination issue, then the follow-on rules—
Right, no, but my question is about if we disagree with you on the first issue.
Right, so then you have to look at the lawfulness of those rules per se. And as we explained, to pick one, the social media rule clearly would interfere with the exercise of Section 7 rights in and of itself, because it says no use of social media on the job. First of all, that's totally contradictory to what the written policy is, which permits that, it.
And I appreciate it. I recall that part of your brief, and I just wanted the clarification on whether you were making concession or not, and you're not, which I think
we are not.
A wise tactical decision to not make that concession. My last question is, I take it that it's not lawful for an employer to promulgate rules in response to statutorily protected union activity. But if we conclude that the employer here promulgated new rules in response to union activity that was not statutorily protected, was that lawful?
So this sort of merges with my prior answer. It's part and parcel of the analysis of the lawfulness of the rule, because
it's going to be case by case. It will sometimes be lawful for an employer to promulgate new rules in response to union activity that was not statutorily protected, and sometimes it will not be lawful depending on the rule.
Okay. That's correct, Your Honor. Yes.
I cut you off. If you have more, that's fine by me, but I'm finished with my questions.
No, that's fine. That's correct, Your Honor.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
Why don't we hear from counsel for the board, and we'll give you a few minutes in rebuttal after we hear from intervener.
Good morning. May it please the court. Eric Weitz on behalf of the National Labor Relations Board. I think it might be most helpful for me to start by clarifying what the legal standard in this case actually is. And as a preface to that, the legal standard is not even properly before the court because neither aspect of it was challenged by the union below. There's two components to the legal standard. First, the board's decision in Caesars Entertainment, which overruled Purple Communications, going to your question, Judge Rogers. And so in Caesars Entertainment, the board held, which is current law, that employees do not have a statutory right to use their employer's email system presumptively, and that an employer can restrict access to its email system for any reason or no reason at all, with one exception at issue here, which is that an employer may not do so in a manner that discriminates against Section 7 related activity. And that goes to the second aspect of the legal standard here, which is the board's register guard standard, which again was not contested by the union and is not at issue before the court. But nonetheless, many of the union's arguments are essentially inconsistent or express disagreement with what the board's register guard standard actually is. So in register guard, the board adopted a new standard for discriminatory enforcement. Specifically in that case, it was also in the context of email restrictions. And what the board said was that in order to establish discrimination, the board's general counsel has to prove before the board that the employer had allowed emails of a similar character. So it's essentially a disparate treatment standard where the general counsel has to show that these Section 7 related emails were prohibited, but emails of a similar character were previously allowed. So responding to some of the arguments that the union makes.
What under about the board's barred publishing? You haven't, I mean, that standard isn't the standard we would apply without the baseline that's emphasized in guard publishing.
Well, Your Honor, in guard publishing, the court did not suggest that it was, taking issue with the standard chosen by the board. And that's why, as we point out in our brief, I think the most reasonable way to interpret guard publishing is that the court was essentially applying that standard and that was ultimately a factual disagreement between the board and the court, where the court found, contrary to the board, that in guard publishing, the employer had allowed emails of a similar character because it had allowed other personal solicitations, but then it had prohibited union solicitations. So in that, the court essentially found, applying guard publishing, that those were emails of a similar character. So that's, in our view, just a factual disagreement rather than a legal disagreement. However, even assuming that the court were to read guard publishing as applying a slightly different legal standard with regard to the baseline or otherwise, again, I would just point out that in this case, the union did not challenge register guard for the board. And so our position would still be that register guard is the appropriate legal standard on review in this particular case. And with respect to the baseline in particular, I think part of the union's disagreement with register guard is its focus on, whether the prohibition of the emails here were consistent with the terms of the employer's pre-existing policies. But as the board noted in register guard, that is not the standard chosen by the board because, for example, an employer could decide for the first time that it doesn't want to allow this type of email, even if there's nothing in a prior rule specifically referring to that. I wouldn't necessarily concede that that is the case here. But the relevant inquiry at the end of the day is whether the employer had previously allowed emails of a similar character. And so it was essentially treating disparately these Section 7 related emails.
I think we're on common ground that the ALJ found, and you said this isn't fatal to the board's position. The ALJ found that Beaufort's emails were not covered by the written policies. And as I was suggesting in my questioning of Mr. Ginsburg, I don't think that's the end of the matter. Then we look at what the employer representative said when they disciplined Beaufort, right? And in terms of those interests, we look at whether that has been discriminatorily applied or not. And so are we on common ground that the board did not challenge or disagree with the ALJ's determination that Beaufort's activity was not covered by the written policies, right?
Well, I'm not sure that the board adopted those findings. The board noted that it was only adopting the ALJ's findings as consistent with its opinion. And the ALJ was applying Purple Communications, which was a different for the first part of the standard was a different analysis, because under Purple Communications, the default is essentially reversed, where employees have a presumptive right to use their employer's email system. And it's the employer's burden to come forward with, policies or justifications why it should be prohibited.
Okay, but this is going back to the back and forth triggered by Judge Rogers' first question. I find the the invocation by the ALJ and by the board of Purple Communications and Caesars Entertainment to be somewhat beside the point, because the union here is not claiming a carve out from existing policies as a necessary protection of union activity. The question is a discrimination question, which neither, as Mr. Ginsburg emphasized, neither Purple Communications nor Caesars Entertainment affects the discrimination question. And the union has not challenged the legitimacy of those policies. So the question is, have they been discriminatorily applied? Am I missing something?
No, that's correct, Your Honor. And Caesars Entertainment, neither Caesars Entertainment nor Purple Communications modified Register Guard, but I think the disagreement between the board and the union here is what Register Guard actually says. And, you know, I would direct the court to read Register Guard. The board has a very clear analysis of the standard it was adopting, and that's right. A disparate treatment standard where the reference point is previous emails allowed by the employer, exactly. Not its written policies or even the contemporaneous explanations given by the employer.
Well, that's where we have the Guard publishing opinion, which does very explicitly say we look at the reasons given and not at post hoc reasons. We look at the contemporaneous employer rationale, and where the reasoning, where you can look back and say, well, you know, this was sent on a Tuesday and that was sent on a Monday, and that's a union neutral rationale, that isn't going to cut it under Guard publishing. You're going to look at what the employer claimed was its interest and its reason, and when you apply that to emails that were permitted and emails that, I mean, non-union emails and union emails, and if they're treated differently with respect to that rationale, then you have a case of discriminatory enforcement, no?
Well, again, Your Honor, I think Guard publishing can be read as consistent with Register Guard. To the extent that it's not, I would again note that the union did not request or challenge Register Guard in this case before the board, or say that the board should have applied a slightly different analysis to the extent Guard publishing is different. Again, I think Guard publishing ultimately was just the court disagreeing with the board's factual finding that in that case there were no emails of a similar character. And part of that analysis was, you know, the court did make reference to the explanations given by the employer. But that's not necessarily part of the board's own standard in Register Guard. But even if it were, Your Honor, I would note that factually in this case, you know, when Mr. Elliott sent the email out to the employees in this case, the focus of that email was that this was sort of an unprecedented situation of an employee sending mass emails to hundreds of coworkers. And so, and that, you know, there was an explanation given, unlike in Guard publishing itself, where the employer did not really make any delineation. And the court found that it was therefore discriminating along Section 7 lines. Which, if I could just, in the time I have left, note the other significant factual disagreement with the arguments that the union's making in this case. There's not any evidence in the record in this case that the employer had allowed similar mass emails to be sent by employees. There's evidence of a small number of employees that were sent by the employer itself regarding things such as baby showers or you know, free food and events such as that.
There's a lost power cord or something like that?
Yes, one non-supervisory employee, although in a different classification, sent an email out about a lost charger.
Right, and there's nothing in the policies that says, you know, employees of this classification have different rights than employees of that classification. And so that is evidence of discrimination. That person wasn't disciplined.
Well, there's nothing in the policies, Your Honor, though that classification employee did have access to a facility-wide listserv, which Ms. Befford did not, which is why she had to, you know, circumvent that by sending it manually. But I think the board found that, you know, an email about a lost charger is just not of a similar character as an email, you know, soliciting or inviting employees to attend an outside event.
But under Guard publishing, which everybody cites as governing law, and we certainly are bound by, It's not a question of whether we can look back and make a distinction. It's a question of the distinctions that the employer made at the time, right?
Well, I'm not sure that the court is bound by Guard Publishing, Your Honor, because the issue of the legal standard to apply is not properly before the court because the union did not challenge RegisterGuard, the board's decision in RegisterGuard below. And so I think the board's explanation of the standard in RegisterGuard as applied by the board here is ultimately what should be controlling, and that the court does not even need to get into any further analysis of the legal standard in this case, because in the board's view, this is ultimately just a factual dispute and an application of the standard to the particular facts of this case.
Let me be clear. Were you agreeing with Judge Pillard's premise? That's what I need to understand. As I understood her question, it was that the standard is beside the point, that the question is discrimination. Have the policies been discriminatorily applied? If that's what you agree with, then did not the board have to address what essentially the ALJ found was the discrimination in this case? Sorry about that. In other words, and maybe I just misunderstand this case, but given that, as the union says, there's no change in the standard in the sense it just went back to the pre-Purple Communications standard, the board was finding that the record didn't show that there was a violation of the act, period. In other words, to put it very simply, in a hypothetical, suppose the employer had clearly been discriminating, period, for reason A. The board says reason A is not discrimination because our standard requires you to show B.
Yes. So the board adopted a very specific standard for discrimination in RegisterGuard, which is this essentially a disparate treatment standard. And I think the union, because it essentially has to, says that it's not contesting that standard because it did not challenge it below. But I think the union is essentially arguing for a broader discrimination standard than what the board adopted in RegisterGuard, which is this disparate treatment.
What I understood, and maybe I am incorrect, is that when the board said in Caesars Entertainment that it was overruling Purple Communications, it was shifting the burden. There was no presumption in favor of the employees anymore.
That's correct. So as the overarching question of whether employees have a statutory right to use the email system, that shifted. However, RegisterGuard remained the discriminatory enforcement standard even under Purple Communications. So that has not changed. But the initial presumption of whether they have a right or not does change the overall analysis, which is why the ALJ's analysis in this case was looking in a different context than what the board was looking at.
I just need to be clear. Are you in agreement with what I understood to be the premise of Judge Pillard's question? That there's no disagreement about the standard. The question here is discrimination in whether or not the employer, in those first two responses by the supervisor and then the director, to what they told the employee.
Well, I guess I would disagree with that, Your Honor, because I think under RegisterGuard, that's not the focus of the board's standard for discrimination. The board looks at is there disparate treatment such that when the employer has chosen to prohibit these emails now, which the employer under Caesars Entertainment can do for no good reason or no reason at all. It can simply say, don't send these emails and not provide any reasoning.
So just to clarify that, because I think we're getting somewhere to understanding your position. Sorry to jump in like that, but in your view, it doesn't matter whether there's any evidence in the record of the basis for T-Mobile's decision. T-Mobile need not at the time have had any interest or policy or ground that it was distinguishing between mass emails for personal benefit versus those for organizational purpose. It need not have had that as long as it can be discerned by the board in retrospect.
I think that's correct, Your Honor, because again, it's ultimately this disparate treatment analysis. Although I would note that even under Register Guard, of course, the board noted that, you know, if there's affirmative evidence of anti-union animus, that that was the reason for.
Right, that's a separate issue. Yeah. But when we're talking about comparator evidence and circumstantial evidence of discrimination, so can you, I mean, I take your position is that it doesn't matter whether there is any such evidence, but can you identify any evidence in the record before the board's order where T-Mobile defended its decision, its these disciplinary decisions, by reference to a distinction between mass emails that are sent for personal benefit versus those sent for an organizational purpose?
Well, yes, I think that's a helpful question, Your Honor, because that brings me to a point which I didn't address earlier, which is that the union focuses a lot on that one sentence from the board's decision in this case, as if that is the board modifying the legal standard in some way. That's just the board making a finding of fact, essentially, in this case, that there aren't emails of a similar character. That's the ultimate standard under Register Guard. And so it doesn't need to necessarily turn on this personal versus organizational distinction. What the board's decision ultimately rested on here was that the employer just had not allowed similar mass emails like the ones that were sent here. And I think that's also consistent with the reasoning that the employer itself gave at the time. I wouldn't concede that that's part of the board's actual standard under Register Guard, but I think all of the evidence here is consistent that the employer decided that it did not want employees sending these kind of mass emails. It had never previously done so or necessarily been confronted with an employee doing so. And so as the board found, the general counsel failed to establish this discrimination exception to Caesars Entertainment by producing affirmative evidence of disparate treatment.
So your answer is that before the board's decision, you can't point to evidence that the employer made this distinction, but it's your understanding of Register Guard that it needed.
I think that's correct, Your Honor. And again, that I don't think that distinction in particular was the basis for the board's decision here. I think ultimately the standard is, were there emails of a similar character? And the board found here that there were not, based on the record evidence.
Right. Elliot says, though, and I think I'm understanding that you think it doesn't, this is not the baseline. Elliot's email said, we don't allow mass communications for any non-business purpose. And the board finds that there were, in fact, several emails sent that were for non-work purposes. And the reason that you don't find that to be evidence of discrimination or see that as evidence of discrimination is, I gather, that there is a discernible difference between the kinds of mass emails that were authorized, that were not disciplined, and the email that Bedford sent that did draw discipline. Is that right?
Yes, I think that's correct. And also factually, I think the employer did consistently make the argument that, for example, an email about a lost phone charger and even some of the camaraderie building emails that are in the record in the employer's view were germane to work interests in a manner that Ms. Befford's emails were not.
All right, shall we hear from intervener?
Thank you.
Thank you.
Wait, I have one more question. I'm sorry. Did the board address the ALJ's finding that one of Moran's statements was unlawfully coercive? And if so, where did the board address that?
Well, I think the finding that the union references regarding coercion, if the court looks back at the ALJ's finding, the ALJ used the word coercive, but the ALJ was essentially finding that established an overbroad rule that would have been interpreted as restricting Section 7 protected activity. And so I think it was addressed by the board in the footnote in the second decision before the court, where the board found that employees would not interpret any of these statements to be overbroad rules because they were all made in the context of Ms. Befford's emails, which the board found were unprotected for all the reasons we've been discussing.
And if we disagreed with you about the discrimination, then the right course on that second question would be to remand for application of Boeing?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Counsel for intervener.
Good morning. May it please the court. Mark Theodore representing T-Mobile. I've been following along, obviously, the argument to up to this point, and I just wanted to point out a couple of things about the record you have before you. First is you have more emails in the record from Ms. Befford, both including the rejected emails and the emails she successfully sent, than you do have comparator emails. And you have 9 comparator emails, all of which were sent to a WICC Everyone, which stands for Wichita Call Center Everyone Distribution List. Every person who sent those emails had authority and permission to send those emails on that service. Ms. Befford did not. 8 of those were sent on behalf of management. And when you talk about just to take, and the testimony is all in the joint appendix, the food announcements are all just reminders of things that were already on a calendar for employees. The emails regarding hockey tickets are incentive and morale purposes. 2 of the emails are for signing the car to the CEO, the birthday card to the CEO, and 2 emails were for team building morale issues, lip sync contests, and a salsa competition. And the only email that doesn't really fit in that is the senior representative who sends for the lost phone charger, but he too had access to that. And he also is clearly just seeking a lost item on behalf of one of his teammates. And that is because he says right in the email, we had it in the pod yesterday, or something to that effect.
So is the policy T-Mobile is relying on the policy against the enterprise user standard, that's the policy against unauthorized access to accounts?
Correct. And it also to the acceptable use policy, both of which cover that, and the no solicitation and distribution policy.
So, but she did not gain access to a higher level. She didn't actually, as you pointed out, use those mass access. She couldn't. In fact, she got a message that said, try sending.
Right.
Try to resend with fewer recipients. And she did that.
Well, exactly. But I think the fact that she was able to figure out a way to copy and paste it doesn't mean that gave her permission to do it. And that was all, by the way, the company told her to stop doing. Because you won't find an email in the record from a customer service rep. Befford was a customer service rep. She was the only one who did this. You won't find a comparator email of anything close to what happened here. This is a facility with hundreds of people.
And the policy that prevents a customer service rep from sending an email to the number of people that she is able to access on her authorized account is the acceptable use policy?
Both the acceptable use policy, which prevents essentially junk mail, which is defined as mass emails to people you don't know seeking things, and the enterprise union standard, which specifically says you have to have appropriate authorization. And the authorization processes start with a remedy ticket and specific approvals from T-Mobile management.
Under the acceptable use policy, did her email interfere with the use of the resources for legitimate business purposes? That's not the part of the policy you're relying on.
Well, it did in one way. There is testimony that several people complained about receiving it, which is, how T-Mobile became aware of it.
But did it interfere with the use of the resources, meaning the email system? Because, sometimes you can get spam. I'm actually subject to an email attack right now, and I can barely use my email because I get twice as many non-authorized emails every day.
That's all of us, Your Honor.
But that's not the part of it. You're talking about this is junk mail.
This is junk mail. That's what we had relied on. That's what we've relied on from the very beginning and throughout. And that, there is nothing at all comparable to this in the record. And the board, I think, so found. And when we talk about it, at the end of their decision, they basically say there is no evidence. I don't say basically, there's no evidence respondent permitted employees to send mass emails for their personal benefit, much less for any organizational purpose. That's, I think, the board saying, look, we don't even really have to get to register guard, which is the law, because there's just nothing here to compare it to.
So are you agreeing with Mr. Weitz basically, the guard publishing doesn't apply here? Or do you think you meet guard publishing?
I think we meet guard publishing. I think guard publishing did not, as I read that case, did not disagree with the board standard. It disagreed with what the employer had allowed and not allowed. And it was a factual disagreement. It was not a legal disagreement. And the post hoc rationalization that panel said was basically the employer's post hoc rationalization.
Right.
And that's not present in this case.
You're saying the employer here doesn't even have a post hoc rationalization. The board attributes one to the employer, and that's
correct. That's correct. I don't think they attacked the legal standard at all. And I think you can read this board's decision, though, as saying, look, we don't have to get there because there's nothing comparable to it. There's just nothing there. There's no mass email.
So the distinction, so the T-Mobile didn't have to make any distinction on its policies or on the rationale it offered to Befford between mass email sent for personal benefit or organizational purpose on the one hand and all other mass emails.
That's absolutely correct, Your Honor.
Okay. I have a question about overbreadth versus coercion. Do you see those as two separate issues? And if so, how do you respond separately to them?
I do not see them as two separate issues. I think the board, if you're talking about the separate rules, the board law is pretty clear that if something is considered overbroad, it is coercive.
In other words, sort of a direct message, don't do union activity.
Correct. I mean, it's sort of, when I listen to a lot of this, NLRB precedent in the last 15 years or so has been a lot like a trendy diet, right? It only works for half of the people and then it gets replaced by the next big fad. So you have to sort of look at things in context of how the board's going to try to interpret things. And from the employer's perspective, we always have to be very, very mindful that next big fad could be coming down the pike and change the law in this. And so what is overbroad today and coercive today may not be overbroad tomorrow. And that's Boeing and Lutheran and all those cases.
So you also agree that if, and I know this is not your position, but were we to disagree with you on the discriminatory enforcement point, that with respect to overbreadth coercion, that should be remanded for application of Boeing?
I think that's right.
Anything further?
What did you, I thought that the board said you hadn't offered business justifications. Did you offer business justifications that would apply under Boeing?
We never got there, Your Honor, because they under Caesars, again, if we're talking, and I want to make sure I'm clear about what we're talking about. If we're talking about the supplemental decision in those rules, the Caesars, the board severed those allegations on the very limited basis of whether there was an alternate ability of employees to communicate. Mm-hmm. And the general counsel had no other proof. The union had no other proof. And we submitted, which I actually just replicated at the last portion of our brief, all of the evidence from all of the witnesses, including Beffert, all the witnesses who were engaged in union activity who readily admitted that they had many alternate means of communication.
Anything further?
Nothing further.
Good to go.
Thank you. All right. So counsel for petitioner?
Yes, thank you, Your Honors. So even if this court were to accept Elliott's emailed statement as the employer's rule, which we obviously don't agree the court should do, and I'll address in a second, if you look at the evidence in this case and the ALJ's decision, it was not, it was affirmed, the facts were affirmed by the board at page Joint Appendix 18, which is page 7 of the board's decision. He found another employee, and I'm quoting, sent notification of birthday plans for another employee throughout the facility. Baby showers also may take place in which the staff holds a potluck dinner and people voluntarily purchase joint gifts. So, and a bowling invitation, if done for recognition of work group, would be considered business related. So there is evidence in this record of similar invitations. Ms. Beffert sent one email to each of her coworkers inviting them to a bowling social event to talk about working conditions and to have fun the following night, one time. And we think that even under Elliott's standard is clearly comparable. The testimony, there was plenty of testimony from both the union's witnesses and the employer's witnesses that there was a lot of this sort of email that went around, and that's the basis for the board's finding. I would also just say that if you look at this court's Guard Publishing decision, the court clearly looked at the employer's written rule as well as its explanation, because the basis for reversing the board on its finding that one of the disciplines of the employee for sending a union email was reversing the board's finding that was lawful was because even though the employer said it was for an organizational purpose, the rule didn't speak about organizational purpose at all. So we dispute that Elliott could, after the fact, create a new rule when there is a written rule in place, which, as you've just heard from counsel, was the junk mail rule and the other rules they invoke that didn't apply. So we don't think Elliott can, after the fact, come in and create a new rule. But even if this court were to find that, the evidence in the record shows lots of comparables. And we think the way that the board treated that evidence with the way it applied the register guard standard, the way it explained what the register guard standard was a legal error.
And how do you respond to Mr. Weitz's contention that we only can look at register guard in its own terms? We can't look at guard publishing because you didn't challenge or raise guard publishing, or like, where does guard publishing stand?
I don't understand the argument because as I read register guard, and we discussed this in our reply brief at pages 14 and 15, register guard, and we have all the citations, so I won't, they're in our reply brief. I could read them to you.
No, thank you.
You know, prominently cites this court's decision in Lucille Salter-Packard Children's Hospital for what the basic discrimination standard is. It adopts that standard. When that comes up, there's a back and forth with this court over its application of the standard in that decision. But we don't quarrel with that standard. We just don't think what the board has done here is consistent with its register guard standard, and that this court basically, in register guard, the board stated a proper legal standard, and then this court reversed because they didn't apply it properly, and that's exactly what went on here. They cite that same standard in the board cites that same standard in its decision at the top of the first column in page 3 of its decision, and then goes on to change that standard by saying, well, you have to show organizational purpose or personal benefit. That's almost exactly what the board did in register guard. So we don't have a quarrel with the basic disparate treatment standard stated. We have a quarrel with how they interpreted it to apply it in the case. Just that it's very, very, it's not exactly the same, obviously, because the facts are slightly
very
different, very similar to what happened in those cases.
Just to pin this down, let me ask you in another way. So Mr. Weiss and Mr. Theodore have argued that under register guard, it's more like a rational basis test than it is like a discriminatory enforcement test in another context. They're basically saying if you can, you know, conceive of a reason after the fact to distinguish her email from emails that were permitted, that is fine under register guard.
I heard them say that there is no basis for that argument in the board's decision in this case, in the board's decision in register guard, or in any board decision. The board has never adopted that position. And in fact, in this case, when it cites the register guard standard, again, in the top left column on page 3 of its decision at Joint Appendix 14, they cite the register guard standard, they quote the register guard standard, and that quotation comes directly from a cite to this court's case in Lucille Salter-Packard Children's Hospital. It's just it's a very well-established discrimination standard. So if the board meant to adopt some new, different standard other than that standard, which has been in place for a long time, they had to say so, and they never did. The only place they've said so, with all respect to my opponent, is in counsel's brief, not in the board's decision or in any board decision.
You would concede that the company does not have to distinguish mass emails that are dissimilar from the email in question. I mean, this T-Mobile, I'm sure, sends a mass email to its employees every day, probably multiple times a day, thousands of times a year. And T-Mobile doesn't have to say at the ALJ stage or at the board stage or here, well, we're going to distinguish the email in question that was sent in response to Befford's email. Sorry, we don't have to distinguish Befford's email from all of those thousands of other mass emails, right?
I mean, we have not argued that sort of generic employer email to its employees, say, we're changing the schedules, everybody's coming in a half an hour early tomorrow. We don't consider that a relevant comparator.
Right. And so then the question then becomes the 8 to 10 emails about birthday parties and lost phone chargers. Are they like the thousands of other mass emails that don't have to be distinguished from Befford's email? Or are they similar to Beffert email? In which case, maybe they have to be distinguished. Isn't that the inquiry?
Yes, I think so. Although I would point, the emails that we particularly point to are emails sent by other employees like Beffert to the facility-wide emails about non-work social gatherings. I mean, it's almost identical to what she did here, with the only difference
being... That begs the question, is it almost identical? And well, if we think that it's almost identical, then you're on some solid ground and we have to do a lot of other stuff. But if we think that they're not identical, if we think they're actually quite similar to the thousands of other workplace emails that are sent, then that's the end of the analysis, correct?
That is correct. I would just draw the court's attention again to the ALJ's findings at page 7 of its decision, where he specifically found that other employees, for example, sent notification of birthday plans for another employee throughout the facility, that similar activities.
Right. I get that you think those are.
But you said that if they're different, then they aren't probative of discriminatory application, but don't they have to be different in a way that the policies or rationales the employer has stated make salient, as opposed to a post hoc reason?
Yes. Yes. Although, yes. Yes. Leave it at that. If there are no further questions, I appreciate the court's time.
Thank you. We'll take the case under advisement.